Welcome to CMO Combo, the podcast where we deep dive into the minds of chief marketing officers from across the globe. Every week, we bring you candid conversations with top CMOs who share their experiences, strategies, and insights into the ever-evolving world of marketing leadership.
Hi, Noel. Thanks so much for joining us on CMO Combo today.
Hey, Anthony. Great to meet you.
Before we get started with this discussion today, I'm sure our audience would just love to hear a little bit more about yourself, your background, and sort of what your journey was to your current position at Parcelab.
Sure. Throughout my career, I've actually held a range of different roles, covering both marketing, sales, and product management. I'll briefly tell the story of how I got into marketing, because I actually started off in finance, corporate finance, and then product management. But I was negotiating a deal, this is very early in my career, to basically get the license for a piece of and build a piece of software that was an e-commerce platform for retailers. Mm. And I did the negotiations, and then my boss at the time turned around and asked me would I help set it up and run it initially. And I'd never managed anybody. I'd never done any kind of hands-on go-to-market work before. But I jumped in and I found out that actually my core skill in that area was product management. So we built the product, hosted it, put it on the platform, started connecting customers to it. And I was lucky that I had the opportunity to grow with that experience. So they then gave me marketing, product marketing actually was my first entry in. And my colleague took maternity leave. Mm-hmm. And they asked me to cover for her. And I thought, yes, product marketing is really easy. It's really what you just write what the product does. And of course, then I learned things about ICPs, personas, customer buying journeys, that kind of stuff. And so that was really my foray into marketing. So I was able to really grow as that business grew. And we grew from ground zero to about 80 million in revenue in 2.5-3 years. So it was fantastic growth and a fantastic experience. And that, I think, really set me up for my career. And more recently, I've been more involved with private equity-backed SaaS companies. Mm. And that's kind of designing and deploying creative. We're very much, I would describe myself as a commercial marketer. I'm very data-driven, but I'm very much about growth. I can optimize, absolutely can optimize, like anyone can optimize spend, budgets, team structures. But I really get my kicks when we're growing in a market, and particularly when we're competing. And that's what led to my role more recently as the Chief Marketing Officer at Parcelab.
Yeah, I think we've had some discussions recently on the podcast, actually, about this term revenue marketing. And I don't know if that encompasses what you're talking about a little bit, this kind of almost like growth mindset in marketing, where it's kind of almost correct me if I'm wrong at any point, but I think a lot of people are moving over to that way of thinking of it kind of being like marketing can't just be its own kind of siloed thing. It always has to be geared towards how do we actually grow? What are the metrics that show that what we're doing is working, right? Like it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, for me, that's the dictionary definition of a commercial marketer. So and we will get onto brand later, but brand is critically important, but you have to prove your worth. You know, you have to demonstrate that you're driving the P&L as well. And the biggest part of that for marketers is really to work hand in hand with sales, both making sure the channel has all of the marketing assets it needs when it's reaching out to prospects, but also further up the funnel, up the marketing funnel, build the pipeline. So making sure that you're getting the technology. So for example, at Parcelab, we're a global e-commerce post-purchase platform. So I have to make sure that companies have heard of us, know who we are interested in the product and the platform that we're selling, and really drive that need want from them, and get them to a point where we can then introduce sales to them and bring them down the funnel. And that's very much revenue marketing, where you're driving the top line and you're focused on that. And in marketing, you're always juggling priorities, always. But I tend to start with how do I increase the top line and what I needed to do that, and then quite often build the brand around it. Not exclusively, but quite often.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Yeah, so let's really kind of strip it back then. We're talking today about brand identity and how we kind of grow it and how we cultivate it. What is your definition of brand identity? What does it mean to you? And why is it something that's important for, especially like kind of modern SaaS businesses in particular? How would you answer that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And there can be multiple answers, but I tend to lean on what makes you unique and the story that tells you what makes you unique. But in the minds of your prospects and your customers through your employees. So there's a couple of different elements when I think of it. Obviously, following on from the unique, what's your differentiators? What actually makes you different? What are those proof points? And how, you know, if a prospect or a potential customer is looking at you and your competition, how do they place you? And so you have to place yourself based on your key differentiators. The second one is within your existing customer base, you have to build trust and loyalty, particularly in B2B. This is not a month-to-month subscription. These tend to be big investments in SaaS enterprise tech, for example, and they're long-term relationships that you're building. So making sure there's integrity in your messaging and building trust amongst your existing customer base is critical. A brand also should drive things. It's not just about the colors the LinkedIn post. I've got a good story about that, my view on colors. But it should really influence the purchasing decisions of prospects. And then the final one, which I know we're going to comment on or get to, it needs to attract talent. You know, if you think of the kind of companies you want to work for, the brand is integral to that because you're standing back thinking about what this company does, what it stands for, how it does business. And that's the brand. Brand when it comes to recruitment is really important because the people that you bring in need to associate with the brand, and then obviously they can deliver on its promise.
Yeah, 100%. I love how you're talking about how it comes through the employees and how you attract people like that is making this the kind of company, the kind of culture where people would be proud to work there in a way. I don't know if you've got some examples of when you've seen it done really well or when you've seen it done badly. I can say for my part, the one that sticks in my head is Apple. Whenever I go to the Apple store, I'm just struck by this feeling I get from the people who work there, almost as if they just can't do enough for you. And they're just determined to solve whatever problem it is that you have. And I just almost feel like that is the kind of pride in the culture shows through them. The brand kind of shows through them. And I think it's remarkable when you actually see that play out. I don't know if you've experienced the same thing.
Yeah, I've got a couple of recent examples, but I'll just pick up on what you said about Apple, because I used to work, I've worked in B2B and B2C, and I used to work in the mobile industry, and I've worked with Apple a lot over many years. And, you know, there was obviously the kind of culture and the values that the CEO, Steve, created, Steve Jobs. But when you meet Apple people, they're a bit different. You know, you can feel that they're much more about innovation, and it kind of runs through their blood. And they get, you know, when I was negotiating to do contracts to launch the iPhone and its different iterations, you know, the way they went about it was very innovative as well. So it wasn't just the product, it was how they brought it to market and looking different. Another one for me, one that is actually a customer since I've joined Parcelab, but I've bought from them many times over the year, is Patagonia. So if you think of Patagonia, it's very much about a commitment to sustainability and environmental responsibility. So they're not about fast fashion. They're about how their clothes and their the products that they sell enhance and add to that environmental stability. And so they encourage reuse of their products, etc. But when you think of that, that online, but when you walk into the store and you meet the people that work there, you know, they're typically hikers, environmentalists. They're very involved with that brand mission, and therefore the in-person retail experience that you have dramatically enhances the brand overall, because it's kind of front door to back door in terms of its execution. So yeah, Patagonia and Apple are two really good examples.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's something that's so intangible, isn't it? When you, as a customer, you experience it when you walk through the door.
Yeah.
And it's hard to put your finger on, but I guess it's like, I think it's just, it's maybe it's simple, and I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than this, but just kind of, even at the hiring stage, getting people on board with what your vision is, what the company is, making sure they kind of vibe with it, you know? And in that way, you know that they can be real ambassadors for your brand, can't they? Because they believe it. I mean, it's not, they don't, they're not faking it. You know, they're genuinely like, and because people, I think, especially now, I think, you know, consumers, are, you know, whether we're talking B2C, B2B, whatever, like they're quite savvy, I think. And people, I think, especially, that I know there's been a lot of research recently on the younger generation in particular. And I know in the B2B realm, you're maybe not necessarily dealing with that many young people, probably a lot of millennials, I'd imagine. But I think people have much higher expectations now of like a brand kind of walking the walk when in terms of its values that it has. Do you know what I mean? And demonstrating them. Yeah.
I would say not only do they have higher expectations, but they can be ruthless if you don't deliver on them. And we see cancel culture, and it hard permeates into brands. You know, B2B tends to be a little bit more conservative. But if I was to give you an example, I used to be the CMO at Three Mobile. And one of, even when we were writing the values and hard to attract talent, and we were starting kind of pretty much from zero, creating that company. You have things like open communication as your values and these very generic things. And we decided that ours would be indispensable desirability. And that's what we wanted our customers to feel about us, that we were indispensable and highly desirable. But we did, that wasn't part of the comms externally. That was our values that we used as part of our recruitment. And I remember recruiting people and asking them about this, and they say, you know, why are you interested in the company? And quite often they would say, you speak differently, like you talk through and with emotions that I can connect with. And so when you were talking about culture and brand and building a brand around the culture, obviously there's things like internal alignment. You have to empower employees with the brand, and there has to be authenticity about it. You also have to feel it, even in B2B. You know, when you talk about brands and how you represent them, it's the head and the heart. The head is obviously kind of the communication and the storytelling, but the heart comes from, you know, engaging a customer success manager and getting a problem resolved really well and really quickly, and taking the time to understand your customers' challenges and trying to help with those. That's how you get the heart in B2B business, I believe.
Yeah, and I suppose, again, if we're talking about building from the inside out, it's about hiring people who care enough about what you're doing so that they will actually want to help customers also see the value in this thing. Because they'll be looking at what they're doing, they think, we've got something really great here. And I want, I feel so strongly about it myself that I want other people to feel, because we all feel that, don't we? You know, if you're using a really great like platform, or it's a software platform or a great piece of technology or something, I always want to show people. I feel like people can't help but become ambassadors when they really, you know, see the value in something. It's just our nature as human beings, isn't it? I think.
I have to admit, that's why I joined Parcel Lab as well, because I actually did 7 interviews in about 12 days, and everybody, one of those classic intense interview processes, and everyone that I met, I really liked, and the more that I met, the more I liked them. So that already gave me a feel for their culture and the way they go about things. So even as important for me, when they talked about the product, they could show it to me. Yeah. So they could show me how, you know, a delivery process was happening for customers like H&M and IKEA that we service. but it's the way they spoke about it. And, you know, the value that I like the most in our business is radical ownership. And that you know, ownership of the product, the ability to demonstrate it and show it, even in an interview process, which you don't normally do. So the chief people officer started sharing the screen and showing me the stuff he was working on, and that's cool.
Yeah,
really cool.
Yeah, it is. Because it's not a given, isn't it? Is it? You know, sometimes you get on the phone or a call with somebody like a customer service person, and they're so kind of detached from the product itself. You know, it's clear that they're just reading a script of what you said. So even though it seems like common sense knowledge that, like, if you're on customer support or customer success or whatever, you would know exactly how to advise somebody on a product. It's not always the case, you know, and it probably isn't the case with interviews as well. So I think very often it's and I'm kind of curious about, like, how this potentially goes wrong. Like, so I guess we'll dig now into kind of what. Let's like the kind of more practical side of this. Like, let's say you are a company who feels like, you know, I don't even know how far back you want to go with this, but let's say you've been going for something, you've got a brand identity in mind, and for whatever reason you just find that it's not resonating, it's not catching fire, and your employees are apathetic, and they don't even know what it's supposed to be. You know, like what the demand or anything like that, like worst case scenario. What are the first actions you take to fix this? If you say, I'm going to take an inside out mindset in terms of fixing the culture, I think the culture is the problem and the identity. What are the steps that you take? I mean, maybe you could draw from your own personal experience here.
Sure. I'll give you one example. When I joined, I actually joined in my previous two companies, a company called Confirmit. And then we acquired two other businesses, and we were merging together. And the classic thing that you would do is you had three brands, and you would look at each brand and do a brand health check on it, including culture, employee buy-in, etc., market impact. And when we did it, there was one of the brands kind of stood out a little bit more than the other two. But then I took the time to go around and speak to people, and this took about a month. And I spoke to one of the companies that I was speaking to, the transaction had just happened, so they were just meeting and just finding out that they were part of a bigger business. But I very quickly worked out that if we selected one of the existing three brands, then there would be two losers. And that kind of echoes my point of how important a brand story is, and what when people buy into it, they love it. So you can't just change it overnight. You can, but it can have a detrimental impact. And the reason why I say this to answer your question as well is this is the hard work. This is where you have to lean in and find data, speak to people, hear the stories, speak to customers that have left as well as ones that have stayed, and really get your fact base right, because only then can you work out what the problem is. Now, in that example, we had the benefit of deciding that we would take all three cultures, pull them together, and this took 6 months. Involve them in working groups, and we created the new brand together. So actually the story of each of the separate brands was maintained and grew into the new brand, and that's how we came up with Forsta and that particular business. But you know, you really have to dig in and find out what the reasons are that you're not being successful. You know, if I reflect on another example, I was at another very large UK telco, and we were implementing CX and measuring customer experience and NPS and all of that. And everybody was telling me how great the products were and how everything was good. A couple of issues here. But we looked at our broadband product, and the NPS was -20+. And the experience of setting it up and implementing it just wasn't up to scratch. It wasn't. But how we saw it was in the customers leaving us kind of 6 months later, 12 months later, when their contracts rolled up. And of course, part of that was the messaging, the communication. The brand expectation was high, but it was a new product and it was a bit wet. So we had to really bet it properly. And so we then had the data to know why that the brand associated with that particular product wasn't working. And then we systematically went through and fixed everything before we then went and pushed it again in the market.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're bringing people together like that, you know, as you say, and sort of working on the story collaboratively, what are the first questions that you start asking? Because like, I feel like the hardest part is probably the beginning, right? What are the most pertinent questions you have to ask in order to find out kind of who you are? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, there's... I've had the benefit of working with some amazing creative agencies in my career, and one of them, Zero G, based out of Dublin, absolutely nailed this for me. I would probably ask 20, 30, 40 questions until I felt I got to the answer, but they just presented it really differently. And the question they asked is, if you were to describe yourself as an animal, your business, sorry, not you personally, your business, your company, your brand, what animal would it be? And then you had lions, tigers, bears, spiders, elephants, you had all sorts of answers. And then over a period of time, they did workshops to decide the animal you want to be. And at that point, we decided on a lioness, because I didn't realize this, but lionesses are matriarchs of the family. They do all the hunting, and then the lazy lions come in at the end to finish the kill, I should say. And they rear the family and they create the commune, and that we felt that was a very apt association of what the kind of brand we wanted to be. So I think on that, you have to take the time. Questions I often ask is, why do people love us? Not like, but love. Mm. Or why do people hate us? Because by testing the extremities, you tend to get to the truth quicker. And the other thing, to round back on colour, when I was at INSEAD studying, we had a professor, and it was behavioural science. And he said, it always stuck with me, that if you put one B2B marketer in a room with all the colours of the rainbow and ask them to choose one, or you put 100 B2B marketers in a room with all the colours of the rainbow and ask them to choose one, the answer is navy blue. And so in B2B business, people tend to be conservative. And that's why, for me, you have to go to the extremities of love and hate to really define who you want to be.
Yeah. I love that. Did you know what? That just really struck a chord with me, the navy blue thing. I just suddenly realized like how often I've seen navy blue. I've also realized, I mean, I guess this covers brand identity as well, actually, because, you know, mm-hmm. I'm obviously in content mostly. And copywriting, and you know, it's, there are certain words that seem to become, you know, incredibly popular and widespread when everyone sort of, and the one I see all the time is supercharge. I don't know if you've heard that one.
Yeah.
Well, now that I've said it to you, you'll hear it all over the place. It's literally
all everywhere. Over. Yeah, I did some work on radical candor as a behavioral thing of human nature. And, you know, it was all about the types of feedback you give people. And this is part of a brand process. And the word that, so this is a while ago, Anthony, so maybe showing our age difference, but everyone would say awesome.
Awesome.
That was awesome. Yeah, awesome. But what does that really mean? Yeah. what feedback are you giving me? I can understand as a content writer.
Yeah, well, that's an example of like a word, you know, a word that literally means awe-inspiring. That's been so kind of abused and misused that it's stripped of all meaning. It's stripped of all meaning, hasn't it? Like, you know, it's lost its precision. Like, if everything's awesome, then nothing's awesome. Is it? That's the thing. Yeah.
And sometimes it's just an easy word to say, even you're not even sure what you mean by it yourself.
Yeah, I think awesome very often just means like, okay, let's move on. All right, great. So back to this kind of topic then of like kind of the internal culture. I didn't plan to ask this actually, but I just thought it'd be, it's just occurred to me. What are the kind of qualities you look for? Because I don't even know. I imagine you've been involved in the hiring process, right? And you've interviewed people quite often. What are the kind of questions you ask people to get to sort of ascertain whether they're going to be the kind of person who's going to become an ambassador for your brand, who's going to be on board with the vision, who's going to be able to deliver it?
Yeah, so once you've kind of established who you want to be and you're clear on your kind of vision, mission, purpose, you know, the vision of where you want to get to, mission is how you want to get there, the purpose is why you're doing it in the first place, then you can map out a cheat sheet. And I know this sounds very, very simple, but you have to do the first piece of work to be able to know what questions to ask. And then you can basically map the kind of personality traits or way of working for someone into those. So, for example, what one of ours is a challenger mindset, because we're competing in multiple markets. E-commerce is a very challenging and competitive business for the retailers. Never mind for the company supporting them like us. And so, you know, I always ask about what's the thing that you've done that you've most was most out of character for you and why.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah. And you see, I don't want to give all my questions away.
Because yeah, no, I thought that. People taking notes.
People would steal them. But, you know, if you're looking for a challenger mindset, you're looking for someone that's lateral in their thought process. So doing things out of the norm or even thinking out of the norm is a good sign that they would be a good fit, for example. The other things are kind of looking for people who lead and take a step in, but in particular with storytelling. So, you know, this is challenging for introverts, less challenging for extroverts when it comes to interview processes. But, you know, leaning in and leading in how you tell your own story, and then how you tell the story of like your work experience, what you've done, how you've handled challenges. I listen to how they tell the story. And that tells me, particularly for marketing, digital marketing was very much the number one priority for, I would say, the last 10, 15 years. But content and storytelling is the one moving forward. And we're seeing this with, you know, the introduction of AI. Yeah. So, but I want to see how someone thinks as they explain and tell their journey and their life stories.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing, isn't it, how many kind of like capable people you get who sort of, you know, they have all the top grades from the top universities and everything, but they don't quite have their own sort of their own thoughts really about how things should be. I sometimes wonder, like, I think you meet people who are very capable, but I think it takes a special kind of person to really have, I get, like you said, that lateral kind of mindset is much rarer, I think. Actually, it's very important in marketing, you know, in particular, and storytelling, as you were saying. I love how you touched on AI kind of necessitating this need for storytelling now. And of course, I think the reason why that is, of course, is because if AI can replicate so much content that human beings can, then the thing that becomes really valuable is the lived experience that comes through, you know, storytelling, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's now that AI is there, it becomes so much more important for us to differentiate ourselves in that way by using, you know, the kind of, and AI can never replicate that. No matter how well it can write something or churn something out, it can't experience. And that's ultimately, I guess, a foundation of creating trust, isn't it? Is humanity, and showing that, you know, you have experienced the problems that you're presenting to your customer, and you have a solution to them, or whatever it is, you know. I feel like you can't.
Because I've been doing quite a lot of work with AI over the last year and a half, the people that were most resistant to the marketing were the product marketers some of the, you know, the core content creating people. And my articulation to them was like, if imagine having to do work with numbers without Excel. It would just slow you down. So you have to look at AI as a tool. But I have to admit, the more and more I get into it, the more different of a tool I realize it is. One of the things I've been looking at is within ChatGPT, but you can do it within other large language models, is building the persona of your existing customers and then feeding those customers the marketing content that you create and getting opinions on it. And this is all synthetic, right? These are not real people. These are not real people, but it's impressed me how accurate it can be. But what you can do with that is then you can dramatically improve how you're telling your story. So obviously, if you've got an innate skill set, that's amazing. And obviously, we all look for that. But you can really take it to the next level if you use AI as a tool to enhance your storytelling. And that's how I communicate it to the marketing team.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So let's get then back into kind of, you know, because we're talking about this thing, branding and brand identity. And that's like, it's a mysterious thing, marketing, I think, in the sense that, like you said, that it obviously we want to be able to measure it and measure the success of it. And that's all about data. But and yet what we're measuring the success of is something so emotional. You know, it's something that really like people feel, you know, in order for it to work. And that's such a kind of intangible thing. So I'm wondering, like, how do we measure, like, accurately? Like, what are you looking at specifically to know whether, like, your brand is actually resonating? Like, what, you know, I mean, that's probably a really complicated question that requires more than a 2-minute answer, but I don't know. Like, what do you think?
I've got a lot of thoughts on this, but to kind of simplify it, there are tools and brand measurement platforms that you can use. You can also use existing customer sentiment through the CX measurements, NPS, though I know that's kind of needs to be taken in context. Then the other piece is, which I'm glad is back post-COVID, is getting out and seeing people. So I try to attend all of our main industry events. In fact, I'm going this week to the Deliver conference in Vegas, which is the US one of the US e-commerce trade shows. And I like to look at people's face when they talk about your brand and what expressions they have. So you can have the measurement, and it's important, and particularly when it comes to reach. You can look at your PR impact. You can look at your existing customer data and pull it together. But when you're meeting somebody who's maybe considering your capability, so maybe for us, they might be looking for a post-purchase platform. They're ready for that investment. And you ask them, have you heard of us? And they say yes. I always ask them, how do you feel about us? And I never ask about the product or the platform first, because very quickly you'll work out whether they like you or not, based on all of the other impacts I've just talked about, whether they've met anybody that uses your platform, whether they've read anything about you, seen any marketing materials. It's all absolutely condensed into that moment of, how do you feel if you know us? And that's the first question. Obviously, it's different if they don't know us. But if they do, then how do they feel? And when you see someone smile and like react emotionally positively, you know you're winning when it comes to brand management. I've had the opposite experience. I'm sure we all have. You know, you can talk about brands that you've had a bad delivery experience with, and you become way more emotional negatively if you think you've kind of had, you know, been wronged by a brand that way. So that's my kind of final CMO multi-years of experience test.
So
I love spending my time at events where there's prospects, because then I get a hands-on feel for what kind of job I'm doing.
Yeah, I love that as well. Like the kind of, you know, because I think people's like that kind of question, how do you feel about us? I think is the kind of question that people aren't used to getting. So they can't help but react honestly in a way that their face gives them away, because it's quite shocking. You know what I mean? Like no one's expecting anyone to say, like, you know, it's a bit like
normal for me. Maybe I'm one of those left brain people.
No, it's great because people have to answer that. People will give it away from the face, like you said, because it's, you're not expecting it, you know, and you can't help it. I feel like, you know, but I love that. I really like it. On the other side of that, I suppose this is the kind of other side of the spectrum in a way. If you go back to like the complete virtual world, you know, things like social listening, looking at like what people are saying on social media, which I guess is like almost the opposite, because it's like people are completely anonymous. But the flip side of that is that maybe people are quite brutal online. And I wonder if that sometimes is quite helpful as well. What do people say about you when they don't think you're listening? I wonder if that is helpful sometimes as well.
Oh, I think it is. And I will say, I think it's way more important in B2C businesses than B2B.
Right, I see.
Like particularly large consumer brands need to pay very close attention to what people are saying to them online and how they're being represented online. And then, of course, you bring in influencers and just that whole world. In B2B, it's a little bit different because, you know, the platforms are platforms like LinkedIn, Twitter to a point, though, or sorry, Twitter X to a point. And people tend to show their kind of best work self on those kind of platforms.
Yeah.
They don't tend to complain about B2B brands. But where you do see it is, you know, in the customer referencing. One of the places I look, maybe less about customers, more about employees. I look at sites like Glassdoor. You know, I look at what, and Glassdoor's a platform. It's big in the States, really big. And I actually was living in Miami for a couple of years until January. I just moved back to London, and I got a real insight into how existing employees anonymously will comment on the company and what's not right with it, as well as what is right. So I do think that's important for B2B. I also think LinkedIn's a really important platform, both for messaging, but also to see how your content gets engaged. So while it's not necessarily a platform for complaining about things, you know, if your content isn't getting much engagement, that's a sign in itself. And then obviously you've got G2, which is amazing for SaaS tech to have a look at customer reviews and what they like and what they don't like. But the only danger with that is getting too caught up in it, because I also think that in B2B you should know any feedback your customers have on improvements that can be made to the product. You need to stay really connected with them, and that should drive your product development life cycle as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I love how you mentioned about LinkedIn, actually, you know, that kind of being an inherently, I don't want to say dishonest space, but it kind of is. No, in the sense that, like, it's like a big workplace, isn't it? It's not really like other social media platforms. It's very, like you said, conservative in the truest sense of the word, in the sense that everyone's kind of the best behavior, everyone's quite composed, and everyone's kind of, you know, everyone offers kind of praise, you know, but in the spirit of good manners, I think, very often.
I hark back to those days, Anthony, on normal social media platforms, when everyone was a bit nicer to each other.
Oh, I know. I mean, it's, I know, I need to stay off Twitter, to be honest. Like, it's just, if you compare that to LinkedIn, it's like night and day. Like you said, it's just people are so mean, you know. But yeah.
I hear you.
So anyway, let's go back around to what we were originally talking about. Again, this thing, culture, within a company. What are your three kind of, if you had to give three key steps for sort of aligning your internal culture with what you want to show to the world, what would you say they are?
I would say the first one is clear communication. Mm. And I know that sounds very generic, but you have to communicate the journey that you're on, the brand story that you're building as you go. It's not just a kind of one and done thing. And linking that communication, the second thing would be recognition. So if you're on the right track and the behaviors are building, the values are building, the results are coming in, don't be quiet on it. Recognize the people who, you know, in the old fashioned way of saying brand ambassadors, even if they didn't ask to be a brand ambassador, they are if they've delivered success on that journey. And then the final one for me is empowerment. You know, I'm kind of caretaking the brand, but I don't see myself as responsible for it. I see everyone as responsible for it. So I very much empower teams, not just marketing, outside of marketing. In fact, I was in an exec meeting the other day where one of the exec was presenting, and All the other execs were commenting on how on brand his deck was and how they wish they put a bit more effort in. And I know that sounds really frivolous, and it, to some degree it is, but there was pride in presenting the brand in the right way. Yeah. And that's the empowerment piece. Now, I could have stepped in and criticized all the other decks for not being quite right. But of course, that's all I did is focus on the one that was just had its own personality within the brand, because he had taken the effort and he valued it. And so that kind of recognition and empowerment piece is so important. So those are the three things I would focus on.
Thank you so much. That's great. And finally, final question. What is it that you about marketing that you wish you'd known before you got into it?
Really good question. What do I wish I knew about marketing? I wish I'd known before how much fun it was, and I would have got into it. I would have got into it earlier. The other thing I would say is that there's a science to it too, and that you have to take the time to learn it. I would definitely, if I had my career again, put more time into that at the early start of my career.
Yeah, definitely. I love that. You know what? Most people give like really anxiety-inducing answers, and I love how you said, "I wish I'd known how much fun it was." That's such a lovely answer. Thank you. Okay, thanks so much, Noel, for being with us today. It's been fantastic. I'm sure our audience are really going to benefit from this discussion.
No problem. Thank you, and thank you for your time. Really appreciate it, Anthony.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of CMO Convo. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a rating and view on your preferred platform. Don't forget to tune in next week for another insightful conversation with a leading CMO.